Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Juravich. Here's one thing many Americans can agree on. Drug prices are out of control. In fact, it's the fastest growing area of healthcare spending. Half the people in the U.S. take at least one prescription drug. A new KFF poll found that large majorities across political parties want the government to do more to regulate prices. Juliette Kubansky is deputy director of the Program on Medicare Policy at KFF. KFF is a nonprofit health policy research, polling, and news organization. Welcome to All Sides, Juliette.
Thank you, Amy. Happy to be with you.
So President Trump has seized on this bipartisan issue to make several policy changes with regard to prescription drugs, and he recently launched TrumpRx. This is a government website that wants to provide discounts to consumers. And he recently visited Thermo Fisher Chemical. That's a pharmaceutical and biotech company here in Ohio. It's in Hamilton County. And he talked about his administration's initiatives. So how has TrumpRx been advertised to consumers? Do you feel like in your reporting, do people know about it?
Some people know about it. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned in your introduction, you know, the cost of prescription drugs is a real concern for the public. Every time we ask about people's concerns about healthcare costs, prescription drug affordability rises to the top. We have about 40% of people in our most recent poll who said that they felt that the Trump administration's recent efforts to attempt to lower prescription drug prices would benefit them. Mm-hmm. But that leaves the majority of people, you know, uncertain or not convinced that what the Trump administration is doing will help them. We also found that about a third of people had actually heard of the TrumpRx website. So again, not a majority. It's breaking through to some people, but definitely not everybody.
So President Trump and other top federal health officials have repeatedly claimed that TrumpRx offers the lowest prices on prescription drugs. The New York Times just this morning has reported that that's not the case. Does that mirror your findings that you've been finding? Does TrumpRx offer the lowest prices or not?
So we are in the middle of analysis of an analysis that kind of mirrors what the New York Times is doing. But it is definitely the case that, you know, the TrumpRx platform, you know, does lower the price of prescription drugs relative to their existing list prices mm-hmm. here in the United States. But I don't think it's totally accurate to say that, you know, these prices are the lowest prices anywhere in the world. Many of the drugs that are listed for sale or, you know, advertised on the TrumpRx website are brand name drugs that have generic equivalents already. Mm-hmm. So people may actually be better off rather than purchasing the discounted brand name drug listed on the TrumpRx website, simply seeking out the generic alternative. And that would be a kind of surer path to savings on many of the medications that are listed on TrumpRx.
Who is the target audience for TrumpRx? Like, is it for people who don't have insurance, or is it for people who have insurance? Is it cheaper than, you know, your copay for some of them?
Yeah, in terms of who might benefit from using TrumpRx, certainly if you don't have insurance coverage, or if you don't have coverage of some of the specific medications that are listed on the TrumpRx website, you might find that using a coupon available from the TrumpRx website will enable you to save money on those prescriptions. But if you have insurance, you're probably going to be better off using your insurance coverage and getting the benefit of the negotiated price and the copay that is available to you from your insurer, rather than accessing a discounted coupon from the TrumpRx website. It's just not the way that most people are going to see the lowest price on a medication that they need. And another big limitation of the TrumpRx website is that to date, there's only about 50 medications that are advertised out of the 20,000 plus medications that are approved by the FDA for use here in the United States. So it really barely scratches the surface of the many drugs that are available in terms of providing discounted prices.
Okay, yeah, 50 certainly isn't a lot when there's thousands and thousands of drugs out there,
No,
but
right.
what I've heard him talk about is, just to give an example, like GLP-1 medications, which in some insurance companies don't cover. So then therefore, if you go through his website, it might be cheaper, or sometimes it's cheaper to go through the manufacturer. But either way, if your insurance company doesn't cover your drug, then you're looking for another price. Is that right?
GLP-1s is definitely a good example of medications. These are the drugs that are commonly used now for type 2 diabetes, but also very popular treatments for obesity. They have high list prices, and that's been a real barrier to access for a lot of people because, the sheer demand for these medications is so great, and the price has been pretty high. Insurers have pretty, have looked at coverage with alarm because the price times the quantity is really pretty stratospheric. So coverage has been pretty lacking. And the manufacturers realize that there's a lot of revenue that they're leaving on the table because people simply can't afford these medications, even though the demand is so great. So they've taken a lot of steps to kind of bring the list price down. And that is definitely what we're seeing on the TrumpRx website, reflecting the fact that the manufacturers are wanting to increase revenue and they're willing to discount their prices, in order to, hopefully increase the affordability. But we're still talking about a couple to a few hundred dollars a month for these medications, even at the discounted prices. And that's still simply unaffordable for a lot of people because these medications, these GLP-1s for weight loss, need to be taken over time. You can't just take them for a couple of months, lose some weight, and then stop taking them. You have to keep taking them, which means you have to keep paying for them. And so, I think there's some promise here in terms of the TrumpRx website and access to cheaper medications, but it definitely does not solve the problem that many people face when it comes to affording medications in the US.
Yeah, let's talk more about that, affording medications in the US, because the Trump administration has made some policy changes, and he announced what he called most favored nation pricing. Can you tell us what that means? Because that he's comparing us to other countries. What is most favored nation pricing?
So in the president has been fixated, perhaps rightly so, on the fact that here in the United States, we pay higher prices for prescription medications, especially brand name medications, than pretty much anywhere else in the world. We have a very fragmented system of health insurance that gives a lot of leverage to pharmaceutical manufacturers when it comes to setting prices for their medications and increasing prices from one year to the next. In other countries, there's a different system of insurance coverage. Usually there's a national health insurance system, and there's one entity that kind of negotiates prices with drug companies and is actually willing to walk away from the table if the manufacturer doesn't agree to the price that the country is willing to pay. That just does not happen here in the US. So the manufacturers have a lot more power when it comes to setting their prices. The president, I think, rightly points out that it seems pretty unfair that here in the US we pay higher prices for the exact same medication than people in other countries. It puts us at a real disadvantage when it comes to making sure that people can access and afford medications.
So is it like they're negotiating, so like the entire country of France or the entire country of Germany is saying, if you don't bring this price down, then no one in the entire country of Germany is going to take your drug. We'll find something else. Is
That's basically a,
that
yes, that's basically a simplified version of what is
Okay.
happening in a lot of other countries. And we simply don't do that here. So
This
what's
is
happening with the president's push behind this so-called most favored nation pricing is let's bring prices down in the US to levels that people in other countries see through a process of negotiation, a little bit of strong arming, perhaps. So far, we've seen the president announce these sort of so-called most favored nation pricing deals with about 16 drug manufacturers here in the US who have agreed to discount some of their prices to most favored nation levels. We're not exactly sure how they're calculating that, but be that as it may, agree to bring those prices down, introduce new prices in the US at this so-called most favored nation level, and a couple of other terms of the deal, including making their some of their drugs available on this TrumpRx website. But a lot of these deals, we know the general contours, but we haven't seen the agreements on paper. We don't know exactly what they've agreed to. We don't know exactly how they're calculating this MFN pricing. So it all sounds really good and it makes a lot of sense, but I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about the long-term durability of these so-called most favored nation agreements.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about drug prices and federal policy initiatives like TrumpRx with Juliet Kubianski of KFF, a nonprofit health policy research, polling, and news organization. Americans receive health insurance either through their employer, a government program like Medicare or Medicaid, or they can use the Affordable Care Act. Do you know the breakdown of how many people get insurance the different ways, or like through their employers or through the government? So basically, like, who has someone helping them with their drug prices and who doesn't, I guess is what I'm asking.
So most people in the US have insurance coverage. We've got about 70 million people who are now covered by Medicare, which is the public program for people 65 and older and younger people with long-term disabilities. We've got about the same number of people who have Medicaid, which is the program, the federal and state program that helps lower-income Americans afford their health insurance coverage. We've got about, I think the numbers are maybe about 20 million people with coverage through the marketplaces, and the number escapes me, but we've got a lot of people who have it, who have coverage through their employers. So again, we've got this umbrella that covers people, but it's a patchwork of insurance coverage, and we've got millions and millions of people who don't have coverage at all. They're just slipping through the cracks, whether because they can't afford it, their employer doesn't offer it, they work for, they're self-employed, they're gig workers. We're not in a situation where everybody's covered. And in this patchwork system of coverage, we've got different rules, when it comes to prices that different payers are actually paying for medications.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Just because you have insurance of some kind doesn't mean your medications are cheaper. It depends on your copay. It depends on your deductible. It depends on how much you pay out of pocket before it kicks in. Right? All
That's
that.
exactly right. Exactly right. So people with Medicaid are best positioned to afford their medications because by law, their out-of-pocket costs are very low, if not nothing. But for other folks with other types of coverage, it really depends on the negotiations that's happening between the manufacturer and that payer, the rules that are in place, if there are any, for maximum amounts that they'll pay. For example, the Veterans Administration, Medicaid also has kind of mandatory rebates. It's complicated, and the rules don't apply universally, and so that leaves patients, even patients with coverage, potentially paying hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars for medications that they need.
I mean, is there a way to fix this without creating nationalized health care? Because it seems like the other countries have it figured out. So that's what President Trump's trying to do. He's trying to figure out a way to negotiate it without completely changing our health care system.
So, there are certainly efforts underway. The Inflation Reduction Act created, which was signed under the Biden administration, created within the Medicare program a requirement that the federal government negotiate prices for some of the highest spending drugs that Medicare covers. So there are ways to bring greater leverage by the federal government into drug price negotiations. That's one example. We weren't doing that before, which doesn't make a lot of sense to people since, as I just said, Medicare covers about 70 million people. So why can't the federal government use its, leverage in that situation to negotiate lower prices. So that effort has been underway for a few years now, and we are seeing results in terms of lower prices being delivered for people with Medicare under that program. But those negotiated prices don't apply to other insurers. So it might be a natural extension of that program to allow that price to be accessed by employers, and also to negotiate the price of more medications. Right now, Medicare negotiates the price of about 15 to 20 prescription drugs a year. But again, as I mentioned earlier, there's
Just
about 20,000 medications. So,
15. That's nothing.
yeah,
Okay.
but again, it's 15 of the highest spending drugs. So it's an area where, there's potentially a lot to be gained if we're talking about drugs where Medicare is spending billions of dollars a year. So it's designed to kind of have the greatest impact. For kind of the most bang for your buck, if you will.
The we'll just end on KFF last Friday released a poll, and in the poll it found that large majorities across parties want the government to do more to regulate prices. So tell me about some of these key findings. I mean, we've truly found a bipartisan issue, right?
Yes, this has definitely been a bipartisan issue. As I said earlier, every time we poll, people talk about prescription drugs and their concerns about affording the medications that they need. Concerns obviously are reflective of the high prices of prescription drugs, and people who take more medications, who have lower incomes, are more likely to say that they have concerns about the cost of medications. And they're also expressing, kind of concerning facts about their behavior when it comes to adhering to their medications because of the cost. Many people say that they skip doses of drugs, or they cut pills in half, or they don't fill a prescription that their doctor ordered because they just can't afford it. And that's a real problem, I think. We have tremendous innovation here in terms of pharmaceutical research and development, and we get new drugs before other people in other countries. But if the price is so high that people can't afford them, we might as well not have
Yeah,
them,
what's the point? Yeah.
Right.
Well, we've been talking about drug prices and federal policy initiatives like TrumpRx with Juliet Kubansky of KFF, a nonprofit health policy research, polling, and news organization. Juliet, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I was happy to be here.
And coming up, we're going to turn our attention to Ohio and what's happening or not happening to lower drug prices. We're going to talk with a pharmacist and a diabetes advocate who's pushing to lower insulin costs. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about prescription drug prices, and we're turning our attention to from initiatives at the federal level to what's happening here in Ohio. On the website for the national organization Patients for Affordable Drugs, stories from Ohioans abound. It's an interactive map of the U.S., and it shows our state covered with red dots. Each one represents a person and their own personal prescription drug story. Jude in Madison County writes that his new kidneys require him to be on two anti-rejection drugs at a cost of about $3,000 a month. He says, if I didn't have insurance, I couldn't afford that. And he wrote that he's also taking 8 to 10 other related medications. Brett in Pickaway County writes that he takes Eliquis, a blood thinner for a heart condition, and he writes that it costs about $100 a month, but if he doesn't take it, he is afraid of blood clots. And those are just two of the stories on that map. Joining us now is pharmacist Ben Link, vice president of pharmacy for 3 Access Advisors here in Columbus. He focuses on using pharmacy data to help organizations better understand and improve the way prescription drugs move through the healthcare system. Welcome to All Sides, Ben.
Happy to be here.
And also with us today, we have Tracy Ramey. She leads the Ohio chapter of Insulin for All. It's a part of T1 International, a global nonprofit raising awareness about insulin prices and fighting for lower costs. Welcome to All Sides, Tracy. Okay, we'll get to Tracy in a minute, but let's go to you, Ben. So we talked earlier in the show about KFF, about the initiative at the federal level. And so we talked with KFF about TrumpRx. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the policy there when it comes to prescription drug pricing. How would you characterize policy attempts at the federal level currently, using TrumpRx as the newest example?
Sure. So I think that when it comes to thinking about prescription drug policy, it's important to recognize that the way with which we get drugs in this in the United States is very divergent. I heard your guests talk about, you know, employer-sponsored health plan versus Medicare versus Medicaid versus an ACA plan versus not having insurance and having to pay the cash price. Depending upon how we get drug coverage depends upon what tools are available to us. So, for example, historically speaking, in Medicare, you can't use a manufacturer's coupon to help pay down the cost of the drug that's precluded from you. But that is something that you can use in private employer-sponsored health plans. So when I think of TrumpRx, I think of it as a tool that is just another kind of quiver in the arrow that you can potentially use to find out if there's a better price for you out there.
Well, and when it comes to the term drug prices, that's a part of the problem because that means different things to different people, right? Is there like a common language or what's the issue around saying drug prices?
Yeah, drug prices is a very nebulous term because it can mean a lot of different things. We have drug pricing benchmarks that we use that appear in our contracts. That's things like the manufacturer's list price, which is a term known as WAC, wholesale acquisition cost. There are the price you pay at the pharmacy counter. That's the one we tend to care about. But more often than not, technically, that's your patient cost sharing or patient pay amount. And it's just a fraction of the total cost that's being paid towards that drug. So there's actually an article written by another pharmacist, Joey Mattingly, who advocated for the idea that we ought to be a little bit more precise when we talk about drug prices and try to be very specific about which price we're talking. Your earlier segment mentioned the New York Times piece. It itself tried to say, well, relative to like the list prices or the total price, this is what we're seeing. But that might not be the price that you or I would pay at the pharmacy counter because of our health benefit package and what it exposes us to of that total price.
Right. The copay that I pay is not the price of the drug. It's just what I happen to pay.
Correct.
Right. So it's my drug price.
Yes.
Okay. Let's try again with Tracy Ramey. She leads the Ohio chapter of Insulin for All, and she's a part of the T1 International, a global nonprofit raising awareness about insulin prices and fighting for lower costs. Tracy, are you there?
I am here. Hi, Amy.
Hi. So I wanted to talk to you about your personal story. Your daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 2018. And for those who may not know, tell us a little bit about type 1 diabetes. It's different than type 2, and it involves managing it for a lifetime. So a lot of insulin. Tell me more about your journey with type 1 diabetes.
Thank you. Yeah, she was diagnosed in 2018 in January. She was having symptoms prior to that. And, you know, as a mama, I think in November, she was diagnosed in January, and in November of the year before, I was like, she has diabetes. I've seen this before. I was an educator at the time, and I've seen it in other children. Then the doctors were like, no, we've already checked. She doesn't have that. And then it kind of turned around, and she did. She was diagnosed in that early January of 2018. What happens with diabetes, what happens with type 1 diabetes is that the body attacks itself. What I mean by that is there are beta cells that help produce the insulin. And in your body, insulin is a hormone that we all need. If all of us did not have that hormone to produce that hormone produced in our body, we would not make it because it transports the blood sugar. Insulin transports the blood sugar to where it needs to be in the body. So with type 1 diabetes, as opposed to type 2, the pancreas is essentially, it's an autoimmune disorder. So the pancreas essentially stops functioning because the cells that are in the body start attacking themselves. And so what happens is you need a replacement for that hormone, which is the insulin that is produced by only three manufacturers currently, this big pharma. So there is Lilly, Novolog, and Sanofi.
Okay, so the Ohio Department of Health lists 1.2 million Ohio adults living with diabetes as of 2024. Mm-hmm. It ranks as the eighth leading cause of death in the state. However, the statistics don't specify if it's type 1 or type 2. But just for the sake of talking about insulin, all type 1 diabetics need insulin to live, but not all type 2 diabetics use insulin. Is that correct?
Correct. So I actually have type 2. And the thing with type 2 is that your body just becomes resistant to the insulin that it's already producing. So sometimes you need a little bit extra help. Some people don't need that. Some people do. It kind of depends on your genetics and other outside factors that kind of affect that. But with type 1, you absolutely will die within 24 to 75-ish hours without insulin. Your body will go into what is called, your blood sugars will be high, which means you'll have like an accumulation of the high blood sugars. You'll go into what is called a diabetic ketoacidosis, or we call it DKA. That's the common term of that is usually like, oh, they went into a diabetic coma.
Mm. And so tell me your experience, what it's been like for your family about the costs for insulin, and what led you to getting involved in this movement to try to make insulin cheaper.
Yeah. So for me, it is fortunately here in Columbus, we have Nationwide Children's Hospital. They have systems put in place so that the children, the effects of diabetes, you won't necessarily have to deal with the higher costs and everything like that. But there has been a time where I was not, if you're uninsured, there's a different issue there. So there's a time that I was uninsured, and I believe like I racked up within like 4 months, like $40,000 in debt.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was a lot. And I'm like, there's no way I can pay this. With my daughter, she is on, so it's not just the insulin that is what needs to be taken. So what needs to be accounted for, I should say. So with, diabetes, it is a system, it's a whole management system, whether you decide to use a pump, which is something that is attached to your person at all times and a continuous glucose monitor, or you decide to use, which is called MDI, multiple daily injections, there still has to be a method of getting the insulin into your body. It's not just like with some medications, you take a pill and you're fine. There are factors that, so with insulin being a hormone, and it's like imagining like another, it's a complete organ of your body has failed to work properly. So you have to kind of take into factors like if she's stressed out, so she has, there are mental health effects that kind of go along with this, so there's other comorbidities. Like, so mentally, she's like having to manage this. It's not just like every day, it's like minute by minute, day by day, how do you feel? And then being a child, you're kind of like, how are my friends perceiving this? How is this going socially? How do I feel? Am I stressed? Am I happy? So not just the like eating of food or exercise affects insulin management, the other factors go into it as well.
Yeah. Ben Link, Vice President of Pharmacy at 3Access Advisors, let's bring you back into the conversation here. So I read two examples at the very beginning of the show, and then you're hearing Tracy's example. How does this align with things you hear in your work about paying for these medications?
I would say it's pretty typical, and probably unfortunately so. The challenge is because our system is so disparate in the way that it handles the idea of drug prices and drug pricing, and whether whichever term we want to use for that, it's the case that much like the current experience being talked about, you can be fine one day and then something changes. You lose a job. If your insurance is tied to your job, your ability to afford and say that drugs were affordable, your perception that they're affordable, can change overnight very quickly because now you're being exposed to the full list price, not just your copay cost share amount. It can be the case for whether you're a Medicare beneficiary or an employee that you don't change jobs, you don't change health plans, but because of something your health plan did, your experience is different next year than it was this year or next month than it was this month because of a change in your benefit package. And so it always feels a little bit like a roll of the dice is what I'd say, you know, I see play out. And I think that creates a lot of anxiety in the space because you just don't have great confidence that tomorrow will be the same experience as yesterday.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about why prescription drug prices are so expensive with pharmacist Ben Link with 3Access Advisors and Tracy Ramey, who leads the Ohio chapter of Insulin for All. And Ben, you were on a podcast back in 2023. You hosted it. It was titled Drug Prices 101. And you identified yourself on this as, quote, a pharmacist fed up with fake, artificially inflated drug prices. So tell me more about that and what led you to being fed up and your work you do with 3Access Advisors.
Yeah, that was a tagline that my colleague Antonio gave me, and I've just adopted it.
But
I was a retail pharmacist for many years, and before that, an intern and a technician at a retail pharmacy. And I remember very much the day when we had a cancer patient who needed an antiemetic, something to prevent nausea. And, you know, the person's insurance didn't want to cover the amount that they needed. And the cash price that the pharmacy I was working for at the time wanted to charge was more than the entire bottle of pills cost us. So they wanted, you know, a portion of the pills to be more valuable than the entirety of the bottle. And that was what clued me into there's something going on here. And over the course of my career, I realized that a lot of it has to do with the way with which we contract for drug prices. Because we don't have a centralized way, for lack of a better term, of looking at drug prices, and we have all of these various different terms, we tend to be in a system where what has historically been the way we do things, we carry forward. So the very first pricing benchmark we have is a benchmark known as average wholesale price, or AWP. It is the drug price that is in almost all of the behind-the-scenes contracts. So it relates to, like, the health plan and your pharmacy, your benefit broker and your health plan or your employer. All of that is largely structured on AWP. And it's been around since the 60s, and we've known since the 70s that it is highly inflated. So, for example, a generic drug, which is what most people take, 9 out of 10 people take generic drugs, the difference between the drug's AWP price and, say, its acquisition cost to the pharmacy is around 85 to 90% off.
Wow.
So hard to think of other things you buy typically with a discount that significant. And it's very distorting because if you get just a little bit of error in that big of a discount, it's actually a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because of how significant.
Yeah, Tracy, I wanted you to weigh in here. What have you learned in your work as a part of the Ohio chapter of Insulin for All about why prices are so high? Earlier, you mentioned that there's only 3 places that actually even make the insulin that your daughter needs. So that's probably a part of the problem. Can you talk to me about what you've learned about why? What do people tell you when you ask them why it costs so much?
Oh, yeah. So it's really, I had never actually heard of AWP, so I appreciate Ben's insight on that. A big thing that we've been focused on, so I am the leader of Ohio Insulin for All, but I also am a member of the Federal Working Group with Tim International as well. And a big thing that we were doing the past few years has been working with understanding this very complex issue, which is that of of patents. So patents, when it comes to medication, is huge because there's something called evergreening. So what happens with medications is that they will get a patent of a medication, let's say, and then they'll change something very small molecularly and say they're holding on to that patent, and they can't it can't be changed. It has to stay within this one system. So with that, it causes there not to be, like, some medications not to have access to the innovation that comes within medical technologies.
Yeah. Ben, tell me a little bit more about the patent thing. Like, can a drug be made? Is this an American thing? Let's start there. Is this America's issue?
Well, to an extent, yes and no. So when drugs come to market in the United States, they have to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Mm-hmm. There's a couple different pathways that a drug comes to market. It can be a new drug application, an NDA product. It can be an abbreviated new drug application, an ANDA. Those are generally the generics. Or it can be a biologic license application, a BLA, which is where insulin tends to fall in, as does the copycat insulins, the biosimilar insulins. And so, in general, if a big pharma company is going to bring a drug to market, they're doing so under the NDA or the BLA pathway. And so if they get approved, they're going to be granted both patents and exclusivity. So exclusivity is slightly different. A medication can be on the market and protected from competition for a period of 10 plus years due to exclusivity rules as well as patent rules. And so the transition happens when patents and exclusivity expire. That's when other generic manufacturers, not necessarily big pharma, come and want to make copycat versions of the drugs. And so they'll do so through abbreviated pathways where they don't have to show the same clinical rigors to get the drug marketed.
Okay. So whenever Tracy said earlier that there's only three manufacturers who make the insulin that she needs, is that because of patents?
To an extent, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the common challenges as it relates to copycat versions of insulins, for example, is the patents around the pen devices. So there's vials of insulin where you have to draw them up with needle and syringe and give them to you. And then there are pens where you can just dial in your dose and click it on the side of your body to give the dose. And so there are patents, because insulin is a drug that has been around for hundreds plus years, not necessarily our current modern versions, but a lot of the patents on the drug product are clearly expired, but on the devices are not. And so that can make it difficult to bring copycat versions. Just one example of some of the thickets that she's talking about. Mm.
Well, Ben Link and Tracy Ramey are going to stay with us. And coming up, we're going to talk about what California is doing to lower drug prices. And we'll also talk about pharmacy deserts and why that is an additional hardship. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Here's one thing many Americans can agree on. Drug prices are out of control. In fact, it's the fastest growing area of healthcare spending. Half the people in the U.S. take at least one prescription drug. And add to this the growing crisis of pharmacy deserts. In Ohio, the Board of Pharmacy reports hundreds of pharmacies have closed in the last decade, a mix of independent and small chain pharmacies, as well as large chains. Still with us, pharmacist Ben Link, vice president of pharmacy for 3Access Advisors here in Columbus. He uses data to help organizations better understand and improve the way prescription drugs move through the healthcare system. Thanks for being here, Ben.
Thank you.
And Tracy Ramey, she leads the Ohio chapter of Insulin for All, raising awareness about insulin prices and fighting for lower costs. Thanks again for being here, Tracy.
Thank you, Amy.
So one goal states are working toward is public procurement of insulin. So in California, for example, public procurement is now available 5 years after the state passed the law. So insulin is about $25 a month. Tracy, tell me what California is doing and what public procurement means exactly.
So, yeah, so it basically just means that the systems where it comes to the large pharma has been kind of skirted. So we're trying to, they're trying to essentially go through channels where it's not, they don't have to rely on big pharma. And like I said, those just three companies that manufacture, there is a kind of a long process that, again, like it took 5 years to get that legislation through, like to actually go into effect. So with us, with the Ohio chapter and other chapters of Insulin for All, we have been advocating for public pharma for a long time, and that is one of our goals between now and 2027 is to have public pharma here in Ohio.
Yeah. So, Ben, tell me more about this public procurement and what California is doing. I mean, $25 a month, that sounds like a reasonable price, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
I mean, it's all relative, right?
Right.
And so I think that when it comes to something like insulin, what California is doing, you know, they're effectively saying that the system as it currently operates isn't working for us. And so in order to manage it, we're going to get involved directly. You might think of it as akin to, say, like a utility being regulated or whatnot. They've taken an aspect of what is otherwise the normal way things are done and put a state hand in the pot,
mm-hmm.
You know, making and supplying or getting access to the insulin themselves to give it to the residents of California at mm-hmm. a price that they know, because within our drug supply chain, there are many steps from the manufacturer to the wholesaler to the pharmacy with more money movement than just that direct flow. You have the health plan sitting there and potentially intermediaries between the employer and the health plan sitting there that can all change the perception of price along the way. And so the state, I guess, in California, they felt that they had to get involved so that they would have the regulation throughout the whole process and know that they could control the end price.
Earlier, Tracy was saying that when she didn't have insurance, like she was in between jobs and didn't have insurance for 4 months, she went into $40,000 in debt to pay for insulin. Does that make sense to you? Is it that expensive whenever you, like, if you don't have insurance, it's just basically not affordable?
Total healthcare costs will skyrocket without insurance, mm-hmm. for sure. I mean, I certainly believe her when she says
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no,
that was
so do I. I just, yeah, but I'm just saying, but the difference between that, so like $10,000 a month to treat diabetes versus California was able to make it $25 a month, that seems like a ridiculous difference.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that the reality is there's very little constraints or controls for prices beyond what your insurer might privately negotiate for you. Mm-hmm. So when we look at the system is generally designed where there is the public price for something, which is generally a very, very high price, because the price that your insurer gets is going to be a negotiated discount.
Mm-hmm.
And most contracts have a provision in them that say we're going to pay the lower of what you charge the public or what we negotiate. So all providers have an incentive to set a really high cash price, especially when you look at the sources of coverage. In the United States, roughly 20-25 million people don't have health care, which, while a lot of people and certainly concerning, the vast majority of us do. So they're operationalizing towards the incentives of the majority of their customers, which are those with insurance.
Tracy, what have you heard in your work about whether Ohio lawmakers want to negotiate to help with insulin prices the way California did, even though it's a long process? Have you heard anything positive from Ohio lawmakers?
Yeah, we have some that are definitely on board, because insulin is a a nonpartisan issue. Like, it can affect anyone at any time. It's not just something that happens when you're 7, like my daughter was. It's something that can happen when you're 25, 50. It was first known for quite some time as juvenile diabetes, but because that is, like, essentially, if you got it when you were a juvenile, before insulin was discovered by Dr. Banting in the 20s, if you wouldn't make it to being an adult. Mm. So that was, it was a death sentence. And now it's not, because insulin is readily available. And kind of going back to the patent issue, like, Dr. Banting gave the patent up for, like, he sold it for $1. And he said that insulin belongs to the world. There are several lawmakers that are definitely on board, and we are working closely with them, and we're kind of in the doing some restructuring, and, like, we're coalition building at this point, and working, because it's, even though it should be simple, like, hey, this should happen, there's a lot that goes into play behind the scenes and making sure that, because there are a lot of entities that would benefit from us not having that here.
Right. Ben, you shook your head whenever Tracy said that he sold his patent for $1. So he was of the mind of wasn't in it for a profit. He was in it to save people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the history of diabetes is very eye-opening. You know, that there were wards of hospitals where children would basically fall asleep and die because there was no treatment. I mean, the stories of the initial activity that they did to give their product that they were developing, and, you know, seeing these kids effectively return to life, are just, I guess, inspiring, but also harrowing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we've come a long way from those early days. The initial insulin products were animal products. We were taking the pancreases of different breeds of animals and extracting the insulin from that. Now we have a much more technologically advanced way of getting insulin, and have long, short acting, ultra rapid acting insulins. But yeah, I think unquestionably insulin is a life or death product for those who need it. And I think a lot of doctors recognize that and feel strongly about the need for people to have that.
Well, okay, we only have a couple of minutes left. I think we could do more shows on this because I'm learning a lot, but also there's still a lot of ground to cover. But I did want to touch quickly on pharmacy deserts and the problem there. So, Ben, a pharmacy desert is just whenever a pharmacy closes, and so there's not a pharmacy around in your area. Is that right?
Yes.
What happens then when you not only have medications that you can't afford, but then you also have to travel farther to in order to get your medications? Tell me about the problem with pharmacy deserts.
Yeah, it's worse health outcomes. I think that if you think about a typical healthcare experience, you wake up sick, you have an earache or something, you go take time off work to see a doctor, get prescribed a medication, and then you need to get that filled to make the problem better. A lot of our healthcare experience is predicated off of getting prescribed something to be better, right? Mm-hmm. And so if the last step can't be accomplished, right? If you can't find somebody to fill the medication, or you have to drive an hour away to get it, that is certainly more likely to lead to poor healthcare outcomes. There's already research that talks about first fill abandonment, the ability that a lot of people don't get the first thing prescribed to them for their blood pressure, their diabetes, if it's, you know, type 2, not the severe type or the more intense type 1, because they can't afford it. Well, what if you can't afford it and it's not conveniently located? If you can't get to the place to give it to you, that's another reason why you're going to abandon it.
Tracy, we only have about a minute left, but in your work for the chapter of Insulin for All, have you heard from people who are dealing with pharmacy desert issues where they have to travel really far to get their medication? Because I know that you have to have insulin all the time, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it is definitely something that we have had members struggle with, especially with a lot of pharmacies closing. I'm sure Ben is aware of what's going on with CVS and their strategies and everything as of late have led to a lot of pharmacies closing, and so it definitely is an issue with our members as well.
Well, we are out of time, but I want to thank you both so much. I want to say thank you to pharmacist Ben Link with 3 Access Advisors. Thank you for joining us today. And Tracy Ramey, who leads the Ohio chapter of Insulin for All. Tracy, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back at WOSU.org/AllSides. You can also subscribe to the All Sides podcast, and every episode is available in the WOSU mobile app. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.